this kind of thing on an established basis. The units are there. When I said there are 605 units, those are operating units. Now, some of them may only be telephone drops because that's their function. They don't need a whole lot of people. They're just handling supplies or something like that. But put this in present terms. When Colonel North believed that he had been ordered to take 2008 TOW missiles and deliver them to Iran, see, there has to be some way that the supply system can let those go. You can't just drive down there with a truck in San Antonio at the warehouse and say, I want 2008 missiles. You have to have authority. And 2008 TOW missiles, I don't know what one of them cost, but it's an awful lot of money. And somebody had to prepare the paperwork for the authorization to let the supply officer release those, and I'm sure they went to a cover unit that North was using for that purpose. But it appears from what we've heard from this that unlike the way we used to run the cover operations, when these things got to Iran, these characters sold them for money. In fact, they sold them for almost four times the listed value of these things. And this is the problem Congress has been having, is what happened to the money after they got that. And you can see how the system developed. You see, originally we developed it on this one-for-one reimbursement basis. Another thing is we never use this kind of supply to deliver grenades to the Contras and charge them $9 a grenade or whatever it was. We just delivered the grenades. It was part of a government program. And the CIA would reimburse the Defense Department. Everything came out even. We didn't sell anything, you see. So I know how it worked in the 50s and 60s, but I can't tell you how it's been working in the 80s. I'm just astounded by what developed. But just like the general not knowing this, we had so many units in so many places around the world. And for instance, we learned that a scientist, as I recall, at Caltech, had learned how to listen to radio transmission that was so brief that a whole paragraph would be a blip, electronic blip, you know, milliseconds. And he learned to stretch that millisecond blip into readable language. He did it with, I think, what electronics experts would say, and I certainly am not one of them, is like this characteristic of the cathode tube that when you turn the thing off for a little while it still glows. Well, this was called I can't remember in a moment, but Rambo, the Rambo effect. And Dr. Rambo realized he could do that with radio waves just as well as the cathode tube could do it. And the Soviets were using this blip transmission on CW wave, constant wave, like Loran, to deliver secret messages. Well, the minute CIA heard about that, obviously they wanted the capability. So we used an Air Force unit to go to one of the major radio suppliers, electronic suppliers for the Air Force, and by feeding CIA dollars into that ongoing contract and without raising any eyebrows at all, we had that company over a period of about a year and a half develop a super receiver capability that could listen to the CW tone, discover that millisecond blip on there, stretch the blip to readable language, and then get a translator to translate from Russian to American. Well, now, that's a tremendous achievement when you think about it, because it broke the whole system of that kind of cryptology, and it did it with dollars that never affected the Defense Department, but we used the defense structure to do it so that the company that did it had no idea that they were dealing with CIA, they just thought it was a part of an ongoing Air Force contract. That's one of the way these things are done. There's a major company in this country in the Fortune 500 listing called EGNG. It's Edgerton, Germershausen, and Greer. And most of their work is in a very highly classified area of operations for the U.S. government. Well, I'm not sure to this day that EG&G realizes that in their earlier days, when they were a somewhat smaller company, much of the funding that went into their company came through this channel, from the CIA to the Air Force and to EG&G, so that EG&G would develop these very, very special things, really, for covert operations, not for Air Force or Army. But there's a lot of companies that have had those contracts, and this is not a small operation. And The only thing that bothered me, and it bothers me today, was that there was no way to let the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff know this. Now, I think my role, since I had just been assigned to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, my work, if you'll remember my earlier bio material, I was 5 years with the Air Force and then 2 years with the Office of Secretary of Defense. And then Mr. McNamara decided to transfer that to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Well, one of my functions there was to become a briefing officer for the chairman so he would know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I think we served quite a purpose there, because from that time on, every time we got into one of these things, I would brief him right away. And that at least kept him alert to this. Now, again, I fail to see that function, we'll say, in this Iran-Contra era. I don't think anybody from NSC was going down to the chairman or the secretaries of the various departments of the military and saying, this is what we're doing, or this is just to keep them current. After all, they have the right to know all this. See?
Right.
It's an important function. It's a much larger function, much more costly function than people realize that it is. And because of the odd way this country has decided to do covert operations, it's almost uncontrolled, except for NSC. And if NSC does not do their job, then it is uncontrolled. And this is the big issue today, even after Ollie North's trial. The NSC members are sitting back and saying, we didn't do any of it. It seems to me the jurors realize they did. They think Reagan was involved, Bush was involved, Weinberger was involved. They had to be involved, you know? But this is the breakdown right now, and we're going to have a hard time restructuring this business again, because all covert operations require foreign alliances. They're all bilateral. You can't take an aircraft and make a power drop in Tibet without letting the Indian government know that you are using their airways to fly to Tibet for an illegal or a covert drop. So we would notify the Indian government, you see, or we'd notify the Pakistani government or the government of Thailand and so on. In almost every covert, in fact, I can hardly think of any way to operate a covert operation without at least a bilateral agreement. Well, if we don't have our agreements in order, how on earth can we work with these other people around the world? And this is serious business. And this is why the other countries around the world have begun to lose faith in the things that we're doing, because either we're not telling them or we're getting them involved in something that they don't want to be involved in. You know, they don't want to be even connected with it.